Start the year off right at Sally Beauty and stock up on hair care for the whole family. For a limited time, all hair care leaders are buy one, get one 50% off. Choose from tried and true brands like Ion, Bioterra, and Proclaim. This sale only happens twice a year, so don't miss out. Shop your Sally Beauty, sallybeauty.com, or on the Sally app. Download it today. Resolve for healthy, gorgeous hair and unleash your potential. Only at Sally.
Welcome. You're listening to the Habits for Success podcast with award-winning author, actor, four-time Ironman triathlete, coach, and TEDx speaker, G. Brian Benson, where he chats up inspiring, creative, and thought-provoking authors, athletes, actors, artists, and entrepreneurs from all walks of life as they share their stories, success habits, struggles, and wisdom that propelled them to their own unique version of success. Be prepared each episode to be inspired, learn something new, and have some helpful takeaways that will provide insight, empowerment, and tools to live your best life.
Welcome to Habits for Success, the podcast. I'm your host, G. Brian Benson, and this week's habit for success that I want to briefly talk about is be vulnerable. To authentically open up requires vulnerability on our part. I realize being vulnerable isn't easy, but it is well worth the effort. I have struggled myself because I too can be quite introverted, but as I continue to share and open myself up, I have found an incredible amount of freedom from the process. And believe me, it doesn't happen all at once. It is a process. Looking back, I would share glimpses of what was really going on inside of me through a blog, a poem, or even disguised in the form of a short film. Just glimpses. It was all that I could do at the time. It was hard for me to share any more than that. The short film Searching for Happiness, which I wrote and acted in a few years back, is a great example. The film's message shows one man's journey to overcome his unhappiness and loneliness. He is eager to learn about how to be happy, but isn't sure how to do it. Without completely spoiling the end, he finds it through witnessing random acts of kindness by strangers. And throughout the film, we creatively highlighted how he views these interactions to strengthen the message. I'm very proud of how it turned out. I didn't realize it at the time, but I wrote Searching for Happiness for myself. I had to open up and be vulnerable in sharing that experience with others because ultimately it was about me. While I didn't fully understand it at the time, I certainly do now and am thankful for the process and opportunity of being able to be vulnerable and share my journey like that. Not only did it help me strengthen my foundation, it was a very cathartic and beautiful experience that made me feel alive. I don't ever want to close that part of me off again. There are few things more inspiring than to see another person become vulnerable and share a part of him or herself. It gives the rest of us permission to do the same. I remember when I felt inspired over a period of time to write some poetry. It was around 2011. A few years after I had left my family business and was really doing a lot of work on my own self-growth process. It was my hope that these words would inspire others to see their true value and worth. Looking back 7 or 8 years later, I realized that the poems I wrote and the words that came through me were once again for myself, just like the film Searching for Happiness. At that time, I had yet to fully embody my self-worth. Those poems that came through me were messages sent to remind me of my worthiness and perfection. I have truly enjoyed the process of creating. It doesn't matter if it's a book, poem, short film, video, or podcast like this. All different and unique, yet they all come from a willingness to share myself from a place of vulnerability. It's worth it, my friends. Do you allow yourself to be vulnerable? If not, why? How could you be more vulnerable? All right, we are back, and I am really excited to share my next guest with you. He's someone whose music I have listened to through the years, and I can't wait to get chatting with him about it. But this is a brief bio, believe me. His bio is incredibly long and impressive, but we're just going to start with this, and we'll probably talk about some of the other stuff during the question period. But Chuck Wild is a Los Angeles composer, producer, and Emmy-nominated songwriter whose best-selling down-tempo chill-out albums that go by the name of Liquid Mind have consistently charted in Billboard sales charts and have hit the number one spot on the iTunes USA New Age chart numerous times. Chuck's career spans 47 years from 1972 to the present, working with some of the biggest names in music, including writing 125 songs and compositions used in TV, films, and music albums, being a member for 4 years of the 80s pop group Missing Persons, as well as creating 15 albums under the Liquid Mind name. Chuck also received a special President's Award from Barbara Wheeler, President of the American Music Therapy Association, in 2009. Chuck, welcome.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
It's great to be here with you as well, and I apologize. My voice is a little raspy. I've been under the weather this week, but I am making do.
No problem.
So let's just start with Liquid Mind. What is Liquid Mind, and how did it come about?
Well, Liquid Mind is the name of a series of very slow relaxation music. And it came about through pain, I must say. In 1987, I was signed to Lorimar Telepictures. And Lorimar was ultimately bought by Warner Brothers. But at the time, Lorimar was the largest television production company in the world. That's why Warner's bought them. I think they bought out their competition. I was working on a TV show called Max Headroom.
Yeah.
Max Headroom was an Emmy-winning show. It was very creative. It was about a computerized character, one of the first to show up in television. And it was a really great show, but the schedule was incredibly bad. I worked 20-hour days, literally, for 3 months, 7 days a week.
Good Lord. Kept
getting more than 3 or 4 hours sleep. Sleeping in... Michael Honig was my co-composer on that, and his wife had a painting studio in their building, and I slept up in her studio with, like, the fragrance of paints and... alcohol and whatever, you know, is used to clean them, the cleaning fluids.
Oh, my gosh. The poisons.
Right, exactly. So, in any case, I started, feeling anxiety for the first time in my life, being sleep deprived, and also something that's very personal to me. More than 60 of my friends died of AIDS. And that was the period, the late 80s, when most of them died. And people were just dying, and it was, like, incredibly intense. And I would not allow myself to feel or process what was going on. I didn't cry. I say sometimes that I didn't really cry about that and process the loss for 5 years after that, until I was in therapy. For some time. Yeah. In any case, I was just trying to survive. The show, thankfully, was canceled. I'm not sure that I would have survived it. It was canceled for being too expensive, not for being a poor show, but it was the most expensive show on television. And in any case, towards the end of the show, I started having panic attacks. And I was in a spotting session with Peter Wagg and all the executives from ABC Television, and I had one of these panic attacks, and I didn't know what it was. I couldn't breathe. I said, I can't catch my breath, and I was hyperventilating. I was probably turning blue or something. I mean, all the things that go along with panic. Mm-hmm. And Peter Wagg says, come on. He grabbed me, threw me in his Porsche, and literally drove 100 miles an hour down Fountain Avenue. No. You couldn't do that today simply because the traffic is incredibly bad in Hollywood. But back then, and the first urgent care place we found, he dragged me out. He went inside and says, this man's having a heart attack. He assumed I was having a heart attack. The doctors all came in and hovered over me, and they said, well, the good news is you're perfectly healthy. And I said,
yeah, great. Thanks.
What do you mean? I'm not perfectly healthy. And they said, you have something called anxiety. And that was a turning point for me, because the doctor then held up two things in his left hand, he held up a bottle of pills. This literally happened. It was so dramatic. I couldn't make this stuff up. He held up a bottle of pills in his left hand. In his right hand, he held up a sheet that said meditation instructions. And then he looked to the left and he said, medication, meditation. It's only one letter difference. And he said they're both equally as effective. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of a long journey for me. Mm-hmm. One of my good friends, who's a wonderful recording artist and such a creative person, J.S. Kingfisher, introduced me to, well, he didn't introduce me, but he referred me to a gal. Her name was Susan Skye, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Susan was like a counselor, and she did rebirthing work. I didn't really connect that much with the work, but I remember one thing that she said. And she said, Chuck, you're a composer. You need to create the kind of music that represents the way you want to feel. Not the way you feel, the way you want to feel. And she said, I want you to go away and come back and bring me some of that music. And it took me about a month because everything I would write would be really fast. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, fast, fast, fast. And computers can make it even faster.
Well, can I ask you a cool question?
Yeah.
So with that being said, all the stuff was fast, and, you know, the show was fast. And, you know, I obviously when you were in the music group Missing Persons, we'll get back to that a little bit later, but that was probably a little more upbeat as well. Did you feel like you weren't being true to yourself, or did it just feel like that was what people wanted, and so I was going to give it, you know, to produce that?
I was having
that.
A great time.
Okay. Okay.
I didn't have any deep thoughts about anything, really. It was just so enjoyable. You know, let's have another double cappuccino. By the way, I haven't had a coffee since January of 1988.
Wow.
I can't tolerate caffeine. I was doing double cappuccinos while I was working Max Headroom every hour, so much so that my assistant quit. He couldn't handle, you know, what the side effects of too much coffee are.
Me too. So, I mean, it's amazing you didn't have a heart attack.
Yeah. Well, it's true. It's probably true. So yeah. Okay. I can thank my parents for that. Anyway, I did go back and do a piece, and it turned out to be the first Liquid Mind piece ever. It's called 0°0, and it was on the first album, which is called Ambience Minimus. And it's 30 minutes long. It's the longest piece that I ever released. I've written some longer ones, but I always ended up cutting them up a bit. And I took it to her, and she said, this is great. And that was the last time I saw her. But she led me on, you know, she started me on this path. And my friend J.S. Kingfisher also said, he said, you know, there's a 38th generation Chinese healer, Master Ni, who's an acupuncturist, and I can't remember where they were located then, but he has two sons, Mao Xing Ni and Dao Xing Ni. And Mao and Dao both treated me almost every day for a year. I was so sick, and I took every penny. They said, you know, you almost killed yourself, Chuck. You're going to need to do herbs for a year, and you need to have acupuncture every day.
Wow.
And I did that. And Mao is on TV now all the time. I think they're both, you know, he's quite famous.
So you really pushed yourself to, the absolute brink.
I did. And then, you know, as to how the name Liquid Mind came up, that's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah.
I got into therapy, needless to say. Everyone was saying, you know, my mom says, are you having a nervous breakdown? I said, no, I'm not having a nervous breakdown, Mom. Call me back later. And she said, well, I hope you get some counseling. So I started getting going to therapy. And my therapist, I was so whacked out. He said, you know, I'm only going to work with you if you will take a mini vacation. I said, I can't take a mini vacation. I can't leave my house. I was agoraphobic. I did not leave my house for 2 or 3 weeks, except when someone was like taking me somewhere and would be with me. But the therapist said, if you want to work together, you need to go somewhere. He says, maybe go down to Laguna Beach. You know, it's close by. It's really beautiful. So I agreed to do it. And I went down there for a couple of days. And I barely left my room. But one time I did go out and sit on the rocks. And I can even spot the rocks now. I went there a few weeks or a few months ago with my assistant. And I showed him the place. I sat there on the rocks. And the sound of the ocean stopped my anxiety. It stopped the panic. And I had no idea. And I thought, oh, my God, that's what the music needs to be like. I may be telling the story a little bit out of order, but... But, you know, she suggested the music. Then I got in counseling. Then, then I heard the ocean and I went, well, if I can make music that is, that...
And the same vibration emulates, or something.
That emulates the ocean that never stops and it goes up and down and it has low frequencies. Because I love that low frequency. So I started investigating music and I found out that the low frequency is very relaxing to human beings. Because we, when we're in the mother's womb, we don't hear high frequency. That's something that can even be very frightening when we are first, birthed into the world. Sure. But the low frequency we've been hearing for ever since our hearing worked. I don't know how long that is. And I also discovered something called music therapists. And music therapy and the American Music Therapy Association. And there's some research to support that these low frequencies help. That's why Liquid Mind does not have a lot of high frequency. I roll it off. I use, equalization. That's treble and bass controls. I use equalization to lower the amount of high frequency. So
wow. Well, I know.
The name from the sound of liquid healed my mind in the moment there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I mean, I know how much I enjoy listening. I've been listening to music for I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years now. I first found out about it when I was doing a workshop at a metaphysical bookstore in, God, I didn't know where it was. I'm blanking out. Somewhere in the Bay Area. And I was looking for something kind of like what Liquid Mind is, and the woman recommended. And I checked it out. And ever since, I've been a huge fan. I love to write to it. I can't write with words. I just put something on that's very kind of easy and gentle and just kind of helps me kind of get into that honed place of listening to my intuition and letting it come through. And it's perfect.
It's absolutely thank you. Perfect. Thanks for the kind words.
of course. I want to touch briefly on all the different organization and areas of healing. You've already kind of touched on it, but that Liquid Mind is making a positive difference in. I mean, veterans with PTSD, sleep therapy, anxiety recovery, grieving support groups, surgical recovery, hypnotherapy, anger management, and palliative care, not to mention all the massage therapists that play it while they're working. How does it make you feel knowing that it's benefiting so many people through their healing process?
Well, it makes me feel really great. It's as I get older, especially, and I think, well, there will be something that survives me that survives and may be here, I don't know, 100 years from now or something.
Oh, longer than that.
But having it used in healthcare settings, because it was my own musical health care, because of that fact, I think it's especially meaningful to me. I will say almost from the very beginning, I started getting letters from people. Email was not that popular in 1994. It was available, but it wasn't common. And certainly there was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. But I started getting letters from people, and they would come in every week. And I'd have a stack of letters, and I think I saved maybe 400 or 500 of them.
Oh.
And it would be very touching to me to read how, my children were born to your music, or, or my parents, you know, my mom passed on while listening to your music, and that's really heavy stuff.
And, it is.
I think, you know, one thing that really that related to me was the uses in addiction recovery. I received a letter from one fellow who worked in the Pennsylvania prison system. And he said, "We use your music every day. The guys call it musical heroin." And I've never repeated that, really. I think he actually may have made a comment on Amazon on one of the albums to that effect or something. But he said it's very valuable because somehow it allows them to slow down the mind. And the reason I say that's personal to me is because in this day and age, we all have friends who are affected by drugs and alcohol and other addictions. And I've lost, I think, I haven't counted lately, but at least two or three friends due to addiction. One very, very recently, within a couple of years. And anything that I can do, you know, to keep people from taking their lives or unwittingly in most cases. So I hear from parents who use it all the time, from pet owners. you know, my pups finally are sleeping. You know, that kind of thing. It's really great. And at some point, there's a gal by the name of Barbara Els. And Barb said, you know, she's a music therapist and the senior research assistant for the American Music Therapy Association. We've been friends for a long time. She sometimes plays flute on my albums. And she said, we need to do what's called a content analysis. And she said, how many emails have you had so far? And I think this was about 10 years ago. And I said, well, I've got all these letters, but emails, it's about 800, 600 or 800. You know, I don't remember. So Barb said, why don't we take the emails that you've received that specifically mention a healthcare use and we'll analyze them. So I analyzed 700 emails and 22% of the people mentioned meditative effects like transcendental experiences, heightened meditative state. 20% mentioned sleep inducement or improved sleep, both for kids and adults. CAM practitioners, that's contemporary alternative medicine, nurses, doctors using hospitals, all that, that was about 15%. Anxiety relief was about 15%. So cancer therapy was 5% of the people. I mean, that's like, you know, it's not a lot, but that's 35 people that use it in cancer therapy. I have a friend named, a Facebook friend named Mike Hawkins. And Mike is a video producer on the East Coast now, but he was a trucker and he was in a head-on collision. And he was hospitalized for a year. And as a result of the collision, which I don't think was a result of his trucking. I think he may have been in a car, actually, and a truck hit him. And he told me, I listen to your music constantly for a year. He's a huge fan. He's a great photographer. And now he does video production and photography. And he sent me a photograph, which is in my living room. And it's just reminds me, you know, that the importance of doing something in our lives that makes a difference for other people. I don't want to be a billionaire. I want to make a living at this. I want to be able to pay my bills, which, you know, I have great gratitude for that.
Sure.
But somebody said one point, the reason I said I don't want to be a billionaire is because I can't remember who said this, but if you want to be a billionaire, give a billion people something they want, something they need. So, you know, in my case, I make a thousandth of a cent when somebody listens on Pandora. Yeah. And I'm really, really happy for that. And it all adds up if you have, you know, hundreds of millions of listens
yeah.
at different times. So,
Nice. Well, I want to talk about your latest album, number 12, or Peace. What led you to do an album on conflict resolution?
Well, the world we live in, Brian.
Yeah. I knew that was coming.
Right. The this is not the world I grew up in, and I'm not saying that really from a political point of view, but I'm saying that from the point of view that people on opposite sides of the coin are less willing to listen to what others have to say. Mm-hmm. We seem to go from I don't agree to violence very quickly.
Yeah.
And we see it every day. Not only every day. I mean, gosh, I don't even want to talk about Chicago because I used to spend summers there. But the level of violence there is just over the top. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the mass murders and things. You know, it's important to recognize that these things happen.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, what can I do? You know, what can I do to change the world one little tiny step at a time? You know, I'm not just going to do nothing. I can't do nothing. And I was reading, something that Martin Luther King said, Martin Luther King Jr., that is. Mm-hmm. And he said, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. So I thought, how can I do this musically? And I thought to myself, you know, all of the albums, all of my albums, the titles of the albums are my path to healing. Mm. I started out, number one was Ambience Minimus. And that was to quiet things around me. I needed to be around the ocean or out in the country or meditating. Mm-hmm. I used to meditate for 2 hours a day. Today, I don't. I'll be honest with you. It's maybe 5 to 30 minutes, but not that much. The second album was Slow World. You know, quit coffee, quit stimulation. I don't need to be overstimulated constantly. I don't need to be able to talk 100 miles an hour. I used to talk so quickly that people would ask me, slow down, Chuck. You know, and moving on from there, you know, it was my journey.
It's all part of your own self-growth process.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I'm not talking so much about the three compilations, which were more concept albums, Rain and Ocean Sounds and Relaxation. Well, that was definitely part of it. But Dream, one of the compilations, was actually for animals. Mm. But I thought, how can I do this within one album? I don't want to wait for another 15 albums to go by. And I thought to myself, I'll make the titles the step in conflict resolution. Because the problem really is people's refusal to sit down with people they disagree with. I'm openly gay. I've been gay for many, many years. I don't remember when I came out. I think I was 26. Mm. And there are people in the world who wish me ill for that.
Yeah.
And I won't be too specific. I don't want to give them airtime. But I am willing to sit down with any one of those and listen to their point of view. Very few people have taken me up on it, but I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to communicate as long as it's in the context of love. And I thought, what if everyone in the world, Martin Luther King's comment, you know, only love can do that. I realized that love is something we all have in common. Some people lose it along the way. But just the ability to love, the ability to communicate with other people in a context of love. Like, maybe I totally disagree with you, but in the same way that a parent can love a child or a child can love a parent that you disagree with.
Sure.
Still, there can be love in the context of that. you know, it's, maybe my friend does something that I wouldn't want him or her to do, but I can still love them. And I learned something too, that I can love someone without trusting them. And I learned later that that's an adage of the 12-step programs, where you have love and forgiveness for your, you know, the addict or the alcoholic in your life. You still have love for them. You can love them. You don't have to trust that they're always going to do the right thing. And that was kind of a turning point for me too. But anyway, I started thinking of titles and shifting them around a lot. And my assistant would help me with that. Jonathan Morozik, he was the associate producer on that album. And now he's the co-producer of the new album I'm working on. And we thought that the smartest thing would be to start with "At the Center is Love." At the center must be there. So that's the first title. The second title is "Communication," the second song on the album, the second piece. And so as long as there's, you know, at the center of love, there can be meaningful communication. So, you know, we acknowledge that at the center is love, where there's a capacity for love, which all humans share, there can be peace. The peace process begins with respectful communication between two people. Yeah. And it's got to be person to person. This whole thing of getting 20 people together and having 10 of them on one side, you know, on CNN or whatever, and 10 of them on the other side, and this whole chaotic way of communicating.
And the mob mentality.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, nobody's able to really just get into that place because they're all worried about what everybody else thinks.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when I sit down and talk, and I do sit down and talk with people I disagree with, and we talk about things, you know, I try to always talk about something that is a shared value. That's where that title, the fourth title, is shared values. You know, how are your kids doing? How's your family doing? You know, are you still in touch with your mom or whatever? Mm-hmm. You know, what did you do this week that you loved doing, that you enjoyed? You know, what was the happiest moment of the last week, or what was a happy moment? You know, we find out that we share values. I think John Lennon's song "Imagine" kind of, I don't have the lyric in my head, but I think there was some, you know, there was some element of that we share so many values, and the fighting that goes on between various countries, you know, doesn't have to do with love. And it goes on all the time in almost every place in the world. It doesn't have to do with love. So, and it doesn't have to do with respectful communication just between two people alone. Yeah. So I thought, I'm never going to change the way the governments are. that just isn't going to happen. But I can change the way individuals communicate. And once we surrender to love, that was the next title, then a level of trust can build up. You know, somebody that I totally disagree with, I can start trusting them just a little bit when I hear about, you know, their family or their friends or what they've done, you know, what they're doing this week in their lives. I get some trust. And when that happens, that trust, another word for it is oneness. And Terrence Yallop, who was the president of Real Music, suggested that title. He said, "Chuck, I hope you can include the concept of oneness." And I said, "Yes, I think that's what happens when we sit down and talk to people. Even if we totally disagree at the end, we agree to respect each other." And at the end, that helps to bring a spirit of peace. You know, as trust grows and we become aware that really all human beings are one, we're the same.
We all want the same things, to love and be loved.
Yeah, so that's it. That's how the concept came. Okay. And
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, any little bit, I mean, you just you know, even with what I'm doing, it's, I feel like I'm kind of sharing my journey and in my own special way and sharing it, and, you know, through books and in a variety of ways, like you're doing with your music and anything that we can do just to kind of share part of ourselves, just to give other people permission to be themselves. Mm-hmm. I think it's a win-win. And we ourselves are learning and growing along the process too.
Mm-hmm. You know, I sent this album out to every member of Congress. Mm. I sent it out to 100 senators, state senators, and plus Puerto Rico. And I sent it out to 435 members of the House of Representatives. I sent it to the president, the vice president, to all 50 state governors. I sent them all CDs of this along with a letter outlining the steps. And I sent it to the 9 Supreme Court justices. And I heard back, actually, from, gosh, I wish I had the letter in front of me, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote me a nice note, and several other people did. And many of the governors, I think about 20 governors I heard from. So maybe if just one of those people, you know, uses that in their work, you know, that would be really important to me.
So. I love it. Yep. What drives you?
Being of service. I would use the word service. Being of service drives me. Also, you know, my daily routine to some degree drives me. The habits that I have. I really resonate with the title of your podcast because habits are the way we change things. There's that, I think Beyonce owns a, or is an investor in a company called 22 Days. And they used to make great protein bars. I sure wish they'd bring them back. They've been off the market for 4 months. They were, they're vegan protein bars. Yeah. But the reason it's called 22 days is because they're saying that it takes 22 days to instill a new habit.
Right.
And I found that to be true. You know, it takes a few weeks. So one of the habits that I really love, and my dad was a great optimist. He didn't belong to the Optimist Club, and I don't either, but I love their creed. And I think if there was an Optimist Club near where I live, I would certainly do that because it's for kids. You know, a lot of the work is for kids. And it has things like promise yourself to be so strong that nothing can disturb your peace of mind. Oh, my gosh. Because in today, you know, in this day and age, the chaos that the media really perpetrates on us. The media today is very different than Walter Cronkite's evening news when I was growing up, when he was always very encouraging and just read the news, you know, amazing. But one of the ones that I really love is to give so much time to the improvement of myself that I have no time to criticize others. It's easy for me to get in that place of, well, they're doing that. How could they say that? How could he say that? He's a government official. How could he, you know, tweet that or whatever?
Yeah.
Just focus on myself. You know, another one that I love is forget the mistakes of the past and press on to the greater achievements of the future. Mm-hmm. There are these 10 promises that you make yourself, and that's in the Optimist Creed. So that's a really important thing for me. Another habit, when I was 11 years old, my grandfather gave me a book called As a Man Thinketh.
Sure.
Now there's a book called As a Woman Thinketh as well. So the gals are not left out in any way, but that, you know, I think it was written in 1890 or something like that. And that's just the way it was. But the idea of that book is very simple and it's so short. And if anybody hasn't read it, there are a million, not a million, but there are probably a dozen free PDFs of it. And the basic thought of it is so simple. The seeds of your thought create the garden of your experience.
Absolutely.
And that is just so profound for me. I'm so glad that I was introduced to that when I was 11 years old. I didn't get it, I'll be honest. I thought, right. Well, that's okay, you know. I kept the book and I referred to it every now and then. But I just love the thought that what I'm thinking really influences me.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My parents, I don't really remember exactly what were on them, but my parents had me listen to affirmation tapes, cassettes, when I was probably 10 or 11. And I would just go into the living room and turn the lights off and listen to them. And, you know, ever since then, I think, when I was 3, I told my mom I was put here to inspire people. So in some ways, I feel like I've kind of always known my life's mission, and it didn't really begin to show itself until 10 years ago. But I am also of the belief that by working on ourselves, that's the most important thing that we can do. And if everybody did that, you really learned how to just love and accept themselves for who they were and what they had to work with, this world would be completely different.
Yes, I totally agree. Totally agree. Yeah. I wanted to share one other mm-hmm. habit, I guess, which mm-hmm. is almost a daily habit for me. When my friends were dying, may they rest in peace. I have fond memories, not so much sadness, some sadness, of course, but I've processed a lot of that. It's very easy to slip into great sadness and sometimes be locked in there. That can result in depression. And a friend of mine, one of my co-writers that I was working with, Lorimar, she said to me one day, and she's a great songwriter and a great human being. Her name is Sue Sheridan. She's written some number one songs, she has. And she said, Chuck, there's a book called Feeling Good that I think you would really like. And I went, Feeling Good? A new mood therapy, that's what it's called. And I thought, what a title. But anyway, I trusted Sue, so I bought the book. And on one of my trips down to Laguna Beach, I read it, and it truly changed my life. Mm. Feeling Good is a summary and a procedure to use to move from depression, to move out of depression, and to stay out of there. And so many people are depressed. And I've known a number of people that took their lives. Mm. It's, you know, I know a lot of people. There are 10,000 people in my Rolodex, literally.
Mm, wow.
There were over the year, I mean, 70 sure. years, you know, you meet a lot of people. It's very sad to me. And in any case, this book talks about cognitive self-therapy, which was discovered, I think, in the 1930s or 40s by Aaron Beck. And the book talks about that he discovered that Dr. Beck determined that every single patient that he had that was suffering from depression, there were 10 cognitive distortions. He calls them cognitive distortions. I call them stinking thinking. And they're things like all or nothing thinking, black and white thinking. When something happens, you know, just thinking, it's the end of the world, you know. And we see that all the time. I mean, we see that all the time on the news media, where people think that this is the only way it can be, and they go out and shoot other people, or they injure other people.
Yeah.
Overgeneralization is another one of those cognitive distortions, which means that a single event would be a never-ending pattern, you know, that things don't change. Another one that's one of my favorites, and this is a cognitive distortion. It's called jumping to conclusions.
Oh, yes.
Or fortune-telling or negative prediction. You know, I know what's going to happen. If this particular thing happened, then this is going to happen. And it really helps me to know that these are distortions. So I have them all written down on a Word document, the 10 cognitive distortions. And when I'm, I would say,
feeling down
having
or something.
Cognitive dissonance or emotional dissonance. Not necessarily when I'm down. My life is pretty darn happy. I'm filled with gratitude, but when I'm angry, I would say that's more often than not. It has to do with anger at what's going on in the world and feeling I'm helpless. I can't do anything, you know, and I would really like to help. I hate for people to have to go through what they're going through, that kind of thinking, you know. Then I identify which one of the cognitive distortions it is that's related to that automatic thought that I'm having in my head. And then I write a rational response. So it's called three-column work. In the first column goes the automatic thought. In the second column is the list of distortions. And in the third column is a rational response. You know, so, you know, so-and-so got elected. It's the end of the world. Okay? That's all or nothing thinking. That's overgeneralization. It's catastrophizing. That's another one. I'm angry about it, but that's emotional reasoning, which is assuming that a negative emotion reflects reality. The rational response to all that is that that person got elected. Someone else will get elected after that, you know? And that person is one person. Or whatever it is, whatever the case may be.
It just helps you change that. Just turn it around a little bit.
Exactly. It's trained me how to think rationally. And I started doing that around 1992 when all my friends were dying. Listen to that. I said, when all my friends were dying. Well, it was the majority of my friends, but it wasn't all my friends. I still have friends that are alive from back then. You know, some of whom who have had HIV all these years, and they survive and have great lives.
And you made new ones too.
And I made lots of new ones. So, you know, that kind of exaggerated thinking is really important for people who are creative. It's important for me if I'm writing music. You know, I get paid to exaggerate my emotions in music. But it doesn't always work well in my life. You know, that's it's my enthusiasm and exaggeration are really two sides of the same coin. And the cognitive work, which I just do on my own, and it doesn't take but a few minutes to move from being irrational about something to move to being rational and then to be able to, you know, to take steps.
I love it.
One last habit I will share with you. I know I've gone on and on. But
that's all right.
Gratitude list. I start every morning, and I just usually do it in my head. 10 things I'm grateful for. And especially when something bad happens, and bad things happen. They do. That's part of life.
Yeah.
You know, when I had a friend pass on recently, and that's important to me to be, you know, to shift the focus, to process the grief. I do think processing grief is important. But then at some point in time, you know, to shift to gratitude and to say, you know, I really appreciate this. I really appreciate that. I have, you know, what are 10 things? I challenge myself. I say, tell me 10 things that are good about this. Even though it's not a good thing. When if I'm sick every now and then, you know, we all get colds. We all get
me right now.
Right. There we go. Flu, stuff like that. I think of what are 10 good things? Oh, that might maybe only be five, but five good things about having a cold. It gives me time to kind of withdraw and spend more quiet time. And time to heal. And it reminds me that my body has an immune system, which is working. And, you know, it makes space in my life for other good things. I think a lot of times in my life, I've kept myself so busy that I didn't really have mental space to accept other good things. And I think that's where affirmations come in, you know. I do affirmations. And it's an important thing because it opens my mind to the awareness of other things. I would like to mention that when I first started Liquid Mind, I started working for Michael Jackson. I was doing programming. And I wanted to tell the story of how that came about because it was kind of extraordinary. So a fellow named Bruce Swedien, a dear friend and my mentor, a 5-time Grammy winner, he produced the Rhyme and Reason album for Missing Persons. And that was 1984, 83, and I hadn't been in touch with Bruce for a long time. And I met with a consultant to find out how much money it would take to bring Liquid Mind to the market. And she said, "Chuck, I'm sorry to say this, but it's going to be about $125,000.
Whoa.
And I went, and back then it was very expensive. You had to do printing. You had to go to all these, you know, on and on. Mm-hmm. It was CDs and cassette tapes and everything else.
Not as easy as it is today. I mean, there's pros and cons to both.
Yeah. But she said, it's a lot of money. And I said, "Well, Suzanne, I don't have that money." That was Suzanne Doucet. Oh, another wonderful person that has influenced me in good ways and helped bring my music to market. And I said, "Well, I guess I'm just going to have to figure out how to get that money." And I went home and I just sat in the living room and I was meditating in my house in Hollywood. And I was meditating and I was saying affirmations to myself, you know, like, I have all the money I need. And this is the honest to God's truth. 2 hours later, Bruce Swedien called. And he said, "Chuck, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm working with you, Bruce." I don't know where that came from, but I had opened myself to the possibility of that situation. And he said, "Great. Michael needs somebody to program some sounds, and he'll give you a call about it." And I said, "Well, I need a Synclavier. They cost like $250,000. He said, "No problem. I'll have one delivered later today." They rented one, but I said, "Wow. But I don't know how to use it, but I'm sure I can learn." And he said, I'll have Martin Royer, the guy who was renting the Synclavier. He said, "Martin will stick with you for a couple of weeks and teach you how to use it." So that led to 4 years of work for Michael. Michael said, "I want you to make sounds the human ear has never heard." Michael was one of the most focused and patient people I've ever met in my life. And I just have to say hats off to Michael, because I made in the first 2 years, for me, it was a whole lot of money, exactly $125,000, almost to the dollar.
Wow.
And I spent all that bringing Liquid Mind to market. I hired all the people I had to hire. I traveled to all the conventions. I manufactured and everything. And that led to the beginning of the Liquid Mind series.
Ask and you shall receive.
Yeah. In a way, it really is just so important what we think in our minds, you
totally.
Know, and yeah.
No, thank you. No, that's so amazing. I know we're kind of getting close to the end here, but I would be remiss if I didn't briefly talk about some of your earlier years. Now, you grew up in Kansas City, and how did you get started in music? And you know, what was that like for you?
Okay, so it was another case of turning lemons into lemonade. Liquid Mind was the lemon of anxiety into the lemonade of healing music.
Yeah.
At this point in time, I grew up, I was a happy kid, but at 4 years old, I kept falling down when I was walking. One of my legs didn't work right, and I had a congenital birth defect called, what was it called? Perthes disease. Mm. And the only treatment for it then, it was completely healable, and thank goodness it was. I have no problem today with walking or in any way. But back then, the only treatment was to stay off your feet, no weight bearing, for 2 years.
Oh, my God.
I'm 4 years old. Come on.
That's all you want to do is run around.
All you want to do is run around. So my parents, my mom had briefly been a concert pianist. She studied at Wellesley College in the East Coast. And part of her field of study was music. And her father had been a composer, just as a hobby. And my dad's grandmother had been a piano teacher. So I had a lot of music in the background. And my mom and dad decided I should have music lessons. And they hired a gal to sort of care for me and do some cooking. And her name was Edna Amos. I'll never forget her. And I tried to connect with her later in life, but I couldn't. But Edna sat me down. She figured music was the way. And she would sit me down, carry me down to the piano every day and have me play. And Chopsticks was the first song I learned. And then it was Heart and Soul. And then it was Time to Go to Music Lessons and so forth and so on. So Edna taught me how to play piano. And that's how music first came into my life. As soon as I was able to, I guess a little bit after I was towards the end of five or maybe six, I started singing in a church choir. And I really loved that. And I was just fascinated by the huge pipe organ. And I asked the organist if I could sit behind her. Gladys Hamilton Combs was her name. A lot of ladies used three names back then, by the way. I don't know why. You don't see that. Well, sometimes.
Now a lot of them use just one.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so I sat behind her. And after about 2 years of that, I worked up the courage to ask her if I could play the organ. And she said, sure, play it. So my parents bought me a small, a Baldwin organ. And I learned how to play organ. And then eventually I started playing in church for the youth services. And we had a little a chapel that wasn't like the main thing. Sometimes I played in the main church, but that's where I learned how to play meditational music, very slow music. Mm. So I had that in my genes, I guess, in my growing up. Mm. That was my introduction to music. I started singing in high school in choirs and won a bunch of awards. I mean, our groups won a bunch of awards, national awards. My music teacher, a guy named Carter Manning, may he rest in peace. He recently passed on at 95. Mm. Carter was just the most amazing person, so into music, would take us on trips all over the country just to sing, like, you know, the mixed quartets or the male octet or the concert choir. We would go down to Texas and sing and do all this kind of stuff. So that's how I got into music. It was at a very young age, as a result, really, of an unfortunate early event that ended up working out great.
Well, there's kind of a theme going here, and I know that's the exact same theme in my life. It's like a lot of times when things happen to us, they turn out to be blessings in disguise.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Looking for gratitude in every situation.
Absolutely. So I have to finish with this. I was a child of the 80s and loved all kinds of music and went to a lot of concerts up in Portland, Oregon and stuff. And now, while I never saw your group Missing Persons live, I did have one of your albums. What was the experience of being in that group like as MTV and new wave music started to really leave its imprint on society?
Well, that's a good question. The experience was a lot of fun and financial frustration.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was an amazing amount of fun. I mean, when I think that I played in a group that warmed up for David Bowie at the US Festival in front of 300,000 or 400,000 people, and that I got to shake his hand and be on stage with these people, you know, with Fleetwood Mac. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
I heard them. I was sitting 5 feet away over at the side where they let the artists all watch. You know, you could sit and watch the other performances. Mm. And just these legends. It was very humbling, I would say. It made me realize how little I knew about music. I felt very fortunate to be in the band. I auditioned for over 100 band groups when I came to Los Angeles. And I wrote them all down. I joined the Musicians Contact Service and auditioned for all of them. But I wasn't turned on by any of their music until the Missing Persons audition. And Dale called me on my birthday in 1980. And she said, Chuck, do you want to come audition for us tonight? And I said, Dale, I can't. It's my birthday. It's the 22nd of September. And she said, we'll buy you dinner. You're talking my language. Give me the address. And I went, and I wasn't hired. I didn't make the audition because I couldn't play bass in my left hand at the same time I was
playing. Like Ray Manzarek.
In my right hand, exactly. They wanted a Ray Manzarek.
Oh, my gosh.
And because we didn't have the bass.
How difficult would that be?
It was very difficult, but thank goodness for me being able to see beyond obstacles. Okay, what do I need to do to solve this obstacle? I thanked them for the dinner, and I said, you know, maybe I'll give you a call a little later and just check in, see how things are going. I went home, and starting the next morning, I wanted to be in that band so badly. I was working a day job from 8 to 5, and I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning every single morning, a habit that I still have now these days. I'm a very early riser. And I got up at 5 o'clock, and I would practice in slow motion playing to the tape of the four songs they gave me until I could play them perfectly. It took me 2 weeks to learn how, you know, to use my hands independently. And I called Dale up and I said, Dale, I can play these songs perfectly. Have you found anybody yet? And she said, no, come to rehearsal tonight. And that night I was hired.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a great lesson about that, and very humbling to be around, you know, to be in something that was almost sort of a big time, to have the number one song of the year on KROQ, which was a big deal back in those days. They were the new wave and really all the alternative music. They were the voice of the future. And to meet all those people, I took a copy of our EP, and we couldn't get it played on KROQ. And it's another example of not letting a closed door literally be a problem. I went and sat in the parking lot because I had already tried knocking on the door, and some of our, you know, promo person tried getting our songs to them, and they just couldn't do it. And I waited until the end of the day, and somebody walked out and the door didn't completely close. So I went running up there. It was about 7 o'clock at night, and a guy named Freddie Snakeskin was on the air. I think it was Freddie. I said, this is our album. You have to play this. I was like shaking. I said, Ken Scott did it. He worked with David Bowie, you know, Ziggy Stardust and all that. And the guy said, well, I'll give it to our programmer. You know, and a year later, we were number one song of the year on KROQ, which led to some Billboard sales, and the album went gold very quickly in 6 weeks, which for us was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
So that was nice. I also learned the hard lesson that the music industry can be a difficult place financially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, equipment was very expensive like that. Back then. So I had over $100,000 worth of equipment. And so any money I made really went for paying for that. And now, you know, those obstacles don't stand in the way of young musicians. You can buy an amazing, system for a couple of $1,000s.
I mean, Wow.
It's astonishing.
Oh my gosh.
So that was my Missing Persons. I'm not in touch with anyone except for Dale these days. Patrick O'Hearn and I became good friends, but he had kids, moved on to the East Coast. I think he lives in Nashville now. And not really in touch with Terry and Warren much. I do see Dale every now and then, Dale Bozzio. She was the lead singer. Sure. And bless her heart, she is still out there singing. She's on tour right now with an 80s revival tour. And they're touring all over the United States. I got to hand it to her. I don't think I would want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I saw it advertised. I mean, there's a huge resurgence. I mean, with Sirius playing, you know, the 80s channel.
And she's singing better than ever. Wow. I was so surprised when I went to one of her shows. And I went, oh, my God, Dale, you are like singing so well. So we hugged and, you know, it's nice to be in touch after all those years.
Mm-hmm. What's next?
Well, next is this album, the album that I'm working on. And I'm kind of still, I'm a little hesitant to bring up the title and the concept because it is another concept album. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing that and I'm kind of moving into the mixing stage. I'm hoping that'll be done in a few months. Liquid Mind albums take me a long time because they're so slow. It really is difficult staying awake. I don't do caffeine. And my assistant doesn't either. He's a young guy, an electrical engineering student from Cal State, but he likes music and he's a great help to me. Mm. And you know, we don't do caffeine, so we can work maybe 2 or 3 hours a day. That's about it. So I'm doing that.
When do you think that will that be out, like in 2020?
Yes, definitely. Maybe the spring of 2020.
Okay.
That's what I would think. And I've kind of made a mental decision to write some choral music. I've sang in choirs for so many years, and I always loved that. And I also think that's a way to, you know, to make a statement in, I don't know, I don't want to be sermonizing here, but it's a way to help bring good to the world. You know, you can write angry and anxiety prone music in any genre, including in choral music. Mm. You know, there's some classical choral music that is not the most peaceful music.
Sure.
But it's interesting that Eric Whitaker, the great choral composer now, who's I'm just so happy to see him getting, so much response, you know, that his music in general is more relaxing and has a positive theme. Not all of it. He does some of the, you know, the classical music, but so it's possible I may move into that. That's kind of in my future. I'm going to be doing a lot of travel as soon as I finish the album, just to catch up with family. Mm, okay. A lot of my family lives literally all over the world, from Tanzania. Whoa. That's Tanzania but it's actually called Tanzania. My nephew's wife is Ethiopian, and she corrected me. She said, "Uncle Chuck, that's Tanzania." I don't know that I'm going to go there, but I have family all over the United States, and I don't get to see them that much. Mm. So I'm going to be doing travel, so that's in my future. And nice. More of the good habits that,
yes,
help me survive. I guess that's what's in my future. You know, when I see something that's not helping me and I want to create a new habit, I'll figure out how to overcome those obstacles with better new habits.
Well, we're always continuing to learn and grow.
Yes, indeed.
And tweaking that. You know, the process, I suppose. Yeah. So,
Brian, thanks for this opportunity.
Oh, my gosh. No, thank you. Yeah, you're welcome, Chuck. Thank you. And I'll have all of the different ways folks can find you in the show notes. But may I share your website for Liquid Mind?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
May I share your website for Liquid Mind?
Oh, yes, absolutely. LiquidMindMusic.com.
Perfect.
And that's really the best place to go. If someone's interested in classical piano, I have written about 20 classical piano pieces. Wow. If somebody's a piano nerd, they could go to chuckwild.com. And they're all up there for free with, you know, PDFs of all the music and everything. It's just kind of a hobby as well. But the Liquid Mind site is, you know, is the one I always recommend.
Perfect. Thank you very much. That was very interesting, and I've always wanted to chat with you, so that was very nice for you to receive my invitation.
Well, thanks again for the opportunity, Brian.
Thank you for listening to Habits for Success, the podcast. I invite you to learn more about the work that I'm doing at gbrianbenson.com, and I hope that you will check out my new book, the award-winning Habits for Success, Inspired Ideas to Help You Soar, on Amazon via the link habitsforsuccessbook.com. Just remember, the only thing that is standing between you and your goals and dreams is a belief in yourself, a solid foundation, and habits for success. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. And we always love making new friends, so please feel free to share this podcast with like-minded individuals. Big thank you to my producer, Casey Jerome Beck. Until next time, be safe, be well, and always be yourself.
A road is just a road, but a Jeep SUV isn't just an SUV. Come see for yourself at the Jeep Start Something New sales event. Well-qualified returning FCA lessees get a low-mileage lease on the 2020 Compass Latitude front-wheel drive for $169 a month for 42 months with $3,909 to its signing. Tax, title, license, extra. Call 1-888-925-JEEP for details. Requires due to contribution lease of Chrysler Capital. Current lease must end by 2-1-2021. Extra charge for miles over 35,000. Residency restrictions apply. Take retail delivery by 2-3-2020. Jeep is a registered trademark.
Celebrate the big 2020 with T-Mobile. Switch now and get two lines for just $90 and two new iPhone 11s on us, so you can take a portrait built for two with the ultra-wide camera.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, cute.
Hurry in to T-Mobile and get two lines for $90 and two iPhone 11s on us with qualifying trade-ins.
Via 24 credits for well-qualified buyers with AutoPay, plus taxes and fees. If you cancel before receiving 24 credits, you may owe up to the full value of your device of $699.99. Contact us. Qualifying port-ins and finance agreements required.